So then we deliberately boiled that pot in with liver and put it out, and we just got a million flies all the time. And they came to it for weeks and weeks. Whenever it rained, more flies came. So you don't have to have maggots and all the associated nuisance and be fiddling around with decaying meat. You just have a nice dry brick in there. Okay, so those two lures, and then a sound lure. You can bring a lot of things with sound. Then the plants themselves along the water's edge. Now, in addition to that, with insects, you can breed the insects for the fish. Now, one ancient and very clever way to get insects to fish is to grow mulberries all along your water's edge and stock them with silkworms. And of course they notoriously, a lot of drunkard silkworms, stumble, fall. There's a small rain of silkworms going into the pond. Of course you can pick them off when they're in pupae and bring them in for the winter and put them back on the mulberries in the spring when they hatch. So they do that naturally with the mulberries, so there's no great fuss about it. And that's what the Chinese have done for centuries, actually. I got hold of a document from AD or BC 900 or something translated, and it says that precisely. It says, around your ponds place mulberries and upon the mulberries place silkworms for your fish to eat. So you can actually stock insects on the right vegetation. And we think a very good plant along our waterways will be that blue echium, because a lot of butterflies come, and trout don't mind if a butterfly's in the water or above the water. It just rises and takes the butterfly. So, the echium. Bees, of course, will be eaten by fish when they come down to flowers. All the jewel beetles. Tea trees, a fantastic provider of fish food. We know in the rivers of Tasmania that when the tea trees are cleared, the trout size falls maybe 12 inches. We'll go from a 7-inch dwarf stocking to maybe a 15-inch stocking if we can get the tea trees back along the rivers. Mainly to do with insect food. Cover, brush, so on. Tea trees, just look upon your pond sides as another sort of insect forage system. The other way to breed insects for animals is in mulch for fish. I haven't worked out the fine details of this, but we find that we get that many slaters or woodlice in mulches, an incredible number, and it would only be necessary for us to mulch in containers, even rafts on the pond, and seed it with woodlice. And when they migrate, they've got nowhere to go but in the water. So you can put breeding systems on the pond. You know, you can float out insect breeding systems. In the tropics, one of the best things is cockroaches and millipedes. And all you throw into your raft is decaying leaves. The millipedes and cockroaches breed and migrate out of those. The other attractant to insects is colour. I got this data from a hippie gathering at where we pitched, I think, about 50 sorts of coloured tents in meadows. The grasshoppers clustered on the green and yellow tents. Just even a yellow balloon on water in grasshopper country will bring a lot of grasshoppers. Grasshoppers also have a fatal flaw. They're nearsighted. If they see a yellow balloon of 6 feet diameter, they think it's a marigold 2 inches across, 5 feet away, and they jump for it. The fact that the balloon's in the centre of the pond is too bad. They're always hitting out for it. They're always going for it in the direction of yellow. They jump. Yeah. If they ever make it, they've got to make it back again, you know. Colour is quite an attraction to grasshoppers specifically. Grasshoppers are great fish food. So you've got all those ways of getting the 65% of your fish food in. Actually, it may be 100% of your fish food if you're really clever about getting insects into the pond.
Phil, with the long trench idea, which is used on the trout farm, using these sorts of systems, how much do you think of the food system on say, a fish farm where there's really not much room around to be...
like this first thing where you've got the little narrow banks and the big ponds, I think you made a mistake in building it in the first place. I think everybody's come to the conclusion you made a mistake. The second way to get food into fish ponds is to start to stimulate the food production within the water. Now what this simply means is that you add manure to the water. Now it's best to do that as naturally as possible, and the very best way to do it is to encourage a lot of birds, waterfowl, onto your water, or to actually run duck flocks on the system. The other way to do it is to have animal housing out over the water, and particularly things like pigs work very well. So you wash the manures into the water or into the drains going to the water. And that stimulates phytoplankton growth, and that rapidly turns into zooplankton, and then you're into the fish chain. That's proved to be very, very successful for all fish low on the feeding ladder. Or you could do a second route. You could put your ducks on these peripheral ponds where you're raising the things like shrimp, which respond very well to manure because they eat algae, and let the shrimp come into the other pond. It's, you can root, you can do a, you can do your step up outside the pond from manure to biomass. Anyhow, it's certain that with things like yabbies, yabbies without ducks and yabbies with ducks, the yield is roughly half that without ducks. You can get actual facts in that from that aquaculture journal. It's near enough to 50% drop in food without a manurial source. The third thing to do is to look at the vegetation of the pond edge for browsing fish. Now, there are whole classes of fish. Some of the best ones are the grass carp, which is a good carp to eat. We don't have it. Well, we do have it in Australia, but we don't have it generally through Australia. And the white amur carp, A-M-U-R. Both of those fish are edge browsers. You can't beat the good old comfrey stuck on the edge of the pond with some lucerne and things, because the vegetation is continually growing into the pond. They will clear that vegetation to 3 inches above the water. They actually put their heads out and browse up the banks. So you've got to trim the pond edge all the time. And it's up to you as to how much edge and how much vegetation which is browsable is on that edge that you put around your pond. Therefore, if you elaborate the edge and really plant it, you really set up an extensive forage system for fish. Given that you have white amur and grass carp, you've got something as good as ducks in the pond, because they're taking from the land and releasing nutrient in the water. You've got a constant transfer of land to water.
Now, what was that first fish, white what?
White amur, A-M-U-R. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. They'll eat them, what, 3-4 inches up? Hmm. Yeah, a browsing carp will browse up out of the water that far. So you can put a lot of stuff in that comes out, and they just take it off. And it's consistently growing. Lucerne and comfrey, excellent. Leucaena's good, of course, too, there in the tropics. And is used. I mean, it's used. And you can grow all these things along the banks. The other thing we shouldn't ignore now is we can trellis out over the water and vastly increase the browse. Here again, you can use the bean groups like the lab and some of the tropical carpeting legumes. One of the very best of these is green leaf desmodium. which will run out over water on trellis, and so will lab. Now this is, I don't know whether we've done it yet, but this is part of the design we did for the taro patches too in Hawaii, is to cover the buns with these running legumes so they run out in the water. Because up till now, the Hawaiians have had a clean bun approach to their taro patches, and we think that's the main labour in keeping terraces, in keeping the buns clean. And we figure, why keep them clean? Why not sow them down to a high nitrogen crop and let those run out in the water where the fish can get them? Because there's little tilapia all through the crop.
You get a problem here with too much nutrient?
Yes, you can. If you overload a system with manure, you know, more than it can take, you get an oxygen loss.
Yeah.
So
what's the sign for that?
Usually faint bubbles coming out of the water and all the fish belly up. it's not usual that you do that. I mean, you need an awful lot of manure washed into an awful small pond for that to happen. If you have a flow-through system, don't worry about it much anyhow. Just put a reasonable amount of ducks and things on the water, you know, a flock or two. Nobody can tell you how many per acre.
Yeah.
On the land, Pukuoka says 8 per acre to ducks is enough manure for rice and also for control in rice. Maybe, you know, you're looking at 20, 30 per acre in water, because it can handle more nutrients than the land can.
The systems in China are apparently the only adjustment they have to make for oxygen.
That's the only adjustment you ever have to make. We'll go into that in a minute. And you don't have to make that all over the pond. That's the point.
What about the problems of ducks and young fish?
Ducks don't eat fish.
Wild ducks do, don't they?
No, they do not. You can get the analysis of... A duck that eats fish is a musk duck. That's very few of those come into inland waters. The
divers
are different. They're cormorants.
Eat
spiders.
No,
eats water spiders. Never find anything but water spiders. Grebe eats water spiders and some algae. You look at, we've got very good stomach content work on ducks in Australia. All published in CSIRO Wildlife Survey Journal. There's no fish in the diet of ducks.
The geese bring the pasture to the dam of
North, geese will float out and crap on the dam. Well, they're the same as ducks. Muscovy ducks, geese. Right. So we're doing all right now. We've got plenty of insects in the air. We've got ponds around. What are we going to put in these peripheral ponds? We can put small forage fish, which themselves are preferably low on the ladder, which are algal eaters or detritus eaters. We can put all sorts of crustacea, shrimp and yabbies. We can put, and then we need to put detritus into these little ponds, which you can organise probably simply by planting the edges. We can put those little amphipods that swim through the water, little green guys that go like submarines, they're excellent fish food. And we can put various chironomid larvae and other larvae of insects. In fact, we hardly need to put them, they'll eventually get there. Snails, another thing, a great variety of snails. Now, snails are always migrating up and down streams, and they're continually coming into systems. Prague come in on their own. If they're not there, dump them in. A few gallons of tadpoles. Frog has been eaten by everything on the swamp. I feel sorry for the frog. Copper snake head snakes are eating them. The eastern swamp heads skin them. Everything eats them. Ducks come back home with frogs sticking out of their mouth, trying to eat their frog before they get home. Poor bloody frog. Still, everything does eat frogs. Owls eat them at night, and the frog mouth eats frogs. The mopoke, the old mopoke, he eats frogs. Hyla.
The program on TV with the bats.
They eat frogs too. Well, Well, your frog is everybody's praise, a gun fodder of evolution, that's for sure. I thought human males were in bad position, but the frog looks worse. The frog's a low man on the ladder, there's no doubt about that. It's frog eat frog, I guess. those big edible frogs eat frogs. Those big ranas. Rana.
Have you got any mosquito larvae problem?
No, nothing could get through this net.
No. What could you introduce to, what would eat mosquito larvae?
Well, obviously fish love them. You don't have them. Mosquito larvae, let me tell you a plain truth about mosquitoes. Mosquitoes aren't bred in ponds. Get rid of that idea. There's no significant accretion to mosquito populations from ponds. Mosquitoes are bred out of manurial pools, like the imprints of cattle hooves. That's where mosquitoes come from. They come from one other source, and that is a little bit of water caught in palms breed a lot of mosquitoes, and they have special algae for those mosquitoes to feed on. If you make that sort of water tank, you need not. You need not. Septic tanks are marvellous mosquito breeding systems, and all you have to do is put a stocking over the outlet. It's still water at high manure value. It's not ponds. Any mosquito person will tell you that. Forget the ponds. You don't get mosquitoes out of ponds. You get into stagnant water with a high algae content that's laying there, and it's temporary water. Boy, that's where you've got mosquitoes.
Just on
the shallow water will breed mosquitoes. So the second set of input to your fish is manures. Now, the manures are from herbivores. And the herbivores can be, or granivores, they can be ducks or geese, or they can be other fish. Herbivores can be other fish. And the third source of input is aquatic organisms. Therefore, you need shallows for those. Now, in the condition where you could make a swamp where you had a fish hole in there and the swamp could be kept level, of course, I think, you know, some like 5-1 ratio and you wouldn't cope with the fish growth. It would be phenomenal. I think that would be the best way to set up fish ponds. Well, you can do two things. You can scoop all the holes and then make the swamp, which would be very practical.
But you've already got the swamp.
Not in the summertime, we don't have.
Oh, dry it out.
Or you can dig in a swamp with a swamp tractor, which has got a wide tread. Actually, I think you can run the tractors where you can't stand. Isn't that true? If you got off the tractor, you would go out of sight. You can't walk to those tractors. The other way to dig them is drag lines. Yeah, drag lines, big backhoe. Yeah, you can cross any swamp, including quicksands that you can't go on, by lifting mats. The tractors that dig them have wider tracks than usual, not much wider. They have a swivelling top with a bucket, right? So they can reach out 18, 20 feet and put this stuff out. You can't get out of the cabin and walk home. You've got to have your lunch out there and everything. The other thing about them is that they have a mat that they lift up with the bucket and put around in front of the tractor and walk on the next mat. They'll cross quaking bogs. They'll go where you can't go, or you can't walk, or can take a wheelbarrow. Those tractors will dig them out.
And
yes, there's a minute pressure on the ground.
What did you call that thing?
Swamp tractor. Oh. Oh, this is a backhoe with a track excavator?
Excavator.
A tract excavator will dig your holes across swamps. There's a guy up the coast goes out in the most god-awful swamps, he takes a very light trailing system out. He trails this thing, it is not even self-propelled. And he just sits in it and digs holes, and then he pulls it along a cable with his tractor. He seems to venture out into boggy tidal areas. He likes it. He likes doing it. A lot of people like doing this. It's really interesting to go across the swamp digging canals. And of course, after you've done it, given that we pull back a bit, after you've done it, you can set up several arrangements. You can put your soil here, or on one side, or the other side. You know, you can play around with where you put your banks. Your banks now become dry planting situation. Super places to grow things, really. Buy swamp, folks. Buy those boggy swamps and those low-lying coastal inundation flats. They are the richest, naturally the richest situations in the landscape. And the cheapest, and the difficulty is only how are we going to use them? Well, this is getting towards it. Right. So no problem. No problem. Or make swamps. See, it's if you have a long, low valley or a flat area of land, you can do all this and then run a bank around it and you've got a swamp. You can go either way about it. It'd be nicer to do it that way because you can define the vegetation of your forthcoming swamp much better than you can one that you inherit. We're going to have a narrowleaf dock across ours forever because it's there. Whereas if we started in the first place, we could have really defined that whole swamp as bee forage and fish forage systems. And a marvellous swamp plant is the comfrey. You haven't seen comfrey till you've seen it on a swamp. Your land comfrey is a miserable looking plant this far across, its leaves are that wide. Should see my swamp comfrey. It's about this big, leaves are that wide. It's a really different class of a plant when you can get marigolds and things into the swamp that really like that country. Bees, of course, can whiz around through the system, through the loosestrife and marsh marigolds and marsh tupelos. Okay, maybe we turn Australia into a swamp one day. Would be better than where it is. The other thing, edge vegetation, we must pay attention to it. Flowering and fruiting vegetation is important because even carnivorous fish directly eat mulberries as they fall in the water, and it's a high protein input. There's only one publication in the world on the edge vegetation of ponds, and it's in Portuguese. I've translated it. Well, it did a class of, it very, very carefully, it did a class of plants that attracted insects, a class of plants that yielded fruit, and a class of plants that were good for browse by fish, and that's what we've done.
Where is this translation? Is it available for us?
It's in my forthcoming book. See the cutting of the man.
I'm buying the book anyhow.
I tell you the sensible thing to do, get your library to order it. Then you can pinch all that information, you don't have to buy the book. Now what can you rear in water? This gets really interesting actually. Yeah, you can. The seal's conversion rate is very, very poor. It's somewhere near about 30 to 1, so you lose out. Eels have a lower conversion rate than fish, 7 to 1, but a totally different foraging system. They don't compete directly with fish. Therefore, they might as well be in the system. There's an excellent book out on the culture of eels by a Japanese gentleman. It's very modern. And it's the only book on eel culture, but it's probably going to stand for many years. Let me tell you the shocking thing the man says. If you can get the elvers, and you have a little elver pond, 16 square metres, and rear them there on a fine food, You then transfer them to two slightly larger ponds, about an eighth of an acre, till they're that long. At that point, they don't migrate out of other ponds. That is, the pond you put them in, they'll stay in. They only migrate when they're really little. At that point, you transfer them out to 4 acres of ponds. So now the total pond involved is 4 1/4 acres. Your expected income is $213,000 annually from that 4 acres at current eel prices.
Give us that again.
You buy that book. Eels are indeed very, very financially remunerative. He also lays out the 18 characteristics for a good eel site. It is that eels are already there. You know that it's a relatively mild winter. Not, he doesn't say a tropical winter. Just relatively mild winter. All the other things, that you have some good natural vegetation for the eels and so on. The swamp fits all those characteristics. I'll lease your 4 acres of the swamp at only about $100 a year and you can make a million. What?
The book is in the library.
Yeah. Who is that Japanese author? I've forgotten. Well, I could pronounce it, I've just forgotten.
This is a translation, I'll tell
you. Yeah, it's in English. But he also says another interesting thing which gives you a great deal of comfort as an eel farmer. He said if we could catch all the elvers in the world and rear them, we wouldn't meet the demand for eels. There is eels are in a category of there being a totally inadequate number of eels for the demand, and that's assessing the whole of the world's eels.
Is there much of a demand in Australia for them?
Don't worry about Australia, we don't want any more demand. You're not looking for demand on eels any more than you're looking for demand on snails. You don't have enough snails in the world to satisfy the snail demand. What's the point of looking for more bloody demand? They've got tankers running from America to Holland all the time just with eels. Tankers running full of eels all the time. Every day, tankers crossing the Atlantic full of freshwater eel. Japan flies in. The one of the best sales you can sell to Japan is elvers. You can fly in elvers all the time if you want to. They're a damn fool to do so, of course, but you can. Sell them live, you can sell them half grown, you can sell them as elvers, you can sell them fresh, you can sell them smoked. Don't worry, you can sell them. Well, you don't have to send eels overseas. You couldn't meet the Melbourne market in eels. Smoked eel. But if you wanted, if Melbourne had enough of your eels, don't worry, you know, the Dutch will send a tanker for them. And so on. So you're safe on eels. No, it's the eels that run into fresh water. They're long and short-finned eels. They're all very much the same all over the world. Anguilla species. Well, we've got Anguilla australis here and other Anguilla rostratus, I think it is. Long-finned eel and the short-finned eels. Don't you worry. You've got eels, you've got eels. Just grow the eels you've got. That's a problem. We could do a little deal with you. Not cheap, mind you. Up Murray's drain. Now come up Murray's drain. All we've got to do is put an elva trap in the drain. Yeah, Murray's got them. We're prepared to do a deal with you. Now the other thing you can grow in water is crayfish. Well, the humble yabby and the marron are doing good. Again, you have the comforting thought that you'll never, I don't think ever, reach a market. You'll never flood market. There's a sad reason for that in the acidic rain areas, all the crayfish are extinct. And those people fly in crayfish from anywhere. See, the Swedes and Norwegians have a crayfish festival every year. They fly them in from Turkey because their owner extinct. The crayfish are generally extinct over the northern hemisphere, therefore it's only in the southern hemisphere we can still produce them. A commercial farm of yabbies looking at 30 to 40,000 a year is 8 acres, but it can be very shallow water, down to 12 inches. So 8 acres of yabbies and you're home and dry. 100 acres of yabbies and you've retired.
Yeah, but you said it doesn't work.
What doesn't work?
Commercial growing.
No, all you do is drift around your 100 acres and sell them when you want to. Let's just use them as a bank. Just put 100 acres in and just to forget work. Retire immediately. You got your money in the bank. They're down there waving their feelers around. You can't go bad like currency. They're down there living. They're what you call a procreative asset. Yabbies, bait fish, is the largest income in ponds. Fish that you provide to fishermen to catch fish, including to tuna fishermen. But bait fish is by far and away the largest pond income. The largest export from Tasmania in pond material is fish eggs, trout eggs, and the pond people here have given up selling trout. There's just no need to. The huge income is from the eggs of the trout. You strip them from the fish, milk the fish. I've done a few billion of them.
What's that for, Bill? Are the trout farms or...?
Yeah. We send them all to the Northern Hemisphere in ice because they haven't got any non-diseased trout. We're sitting on... our trout are not... They don't have any red-eye disease. They don't have all those diseases that are in the north. So when people have trout farms in the north, they like to get Tasmanian or Australian eggs because they know they've got a disease-free stock. And if they get a disease into their stock, they can lose a lot, so they sterilise the whole of the ponds and then get more of our eggs. So we're sitting pretty in the whole world as far as eggs. The export of eggs. They practically give you the fish down here now. They're not interested in the fish. You name it, you know. You can go anywhere from Murray perch to golden belly to tilapia to catfish. Any of them. Well, it's everywhere. Every damned aquarium society has about 10 varieties of tilapia, and most rivers have some wild population. Oh, because you can eat them. Because the whole of the inland fishery has been devoted to sport fishery. That's why. It's been created and devoted to a large class of upper middle class water floggers. It's never been looked on as a production system. Trout farms, eel farms, all sorts of things springing up. Shrimp and prawns towards subtropics to tropics are starting to really, really come up in the fish. And that is a very large income. You're looking at $5,000 for every 8 acre or something on prawns. It's a very big income. It's about 8 times that from yabbies. You grow pineid prawns, which are now commonly available. The Malayan prawns. They're fairly easy to grow. They only want a modicum of duck shit or something, and away they go, and they get big, you know. They're going to outsell the sea prawns in the near future, being produced in very large quantities. We saw the largest prawn farm in the world in Hawaii. How big was it, Wren? 1,500 acres. The prawns are all that big, yeah. About 1,500 acres and just banks and all fed on chicken pellets, weren't they? How ridiculous.
Any of that stock available in the
Oh, yeah. The Panean prawns are available there.
What are they called again?
Malayan prawns, you call them. Call them Malayan prawns.
You wouldn't know where they're available.
Yeah, I think there are people actually growing them in Queensland, Paneas. Well, it depends on your sort of prawn. See, throughout the Murray system, there are a lot of very large prawns, totally unexploited. As of this year, somebody has learnt to rear the giant Tasmanian freshwater lobster, and in 18 months you've got a, I think it's 18 months or 2 years, you've got a lobster about that big. These lobsters go about that big. There's a photograph in a pub in Wynyard of a guy holding the claws of the lobster up here and the tail's on the ground. They've been weighing at 41 pounds, right? Oh. And they're crawling up our rivers, so don't get in the water. let me tell you a really funny story about last year. I wanted to go out and get... Well, you were here, weren't you, Ren? Wanted to go out and get some people who are here a feed of Tasmanian giant lobsters. So I went back into the bush, and all you do is walk up the streams and they sit in the water, poor buggers, and you pick them up, you know. And I walked for miles, and all I could see was lobster baits hanging in there from these rough damn bushmen that fish them illegal, you know. You see, I got it and put it in the bag and brought it home, and that would have to do. So we boiled the water to boil this lobster, and it was boiling away, and I also got some crayfish because I'd failed to get enough lobsters, and I got the lobster out and about to drop it in the water, and we look at the underside of the lobster and there are a million little legs there. She had all these hundreds of young ones hanging on her swimmerettes. My God, and she was that much off the water, wasn't she? Up above the stove she was. So immediately we cradled her up and took her down to the pond. So they're all in my pond.
You didn't eat the little ones?
Oh, no. At that point we decided we were destroying a procreative asset, so we immediately stopped. Yeah, well, underneath that innocent cover of a zola in my pond is a teeming population of giant freshwater lobsters. I hope. I think they are, actually, because they love living in swamps.
How far do you think we can transport these things?
Oh, they all transport everywhere. For instance, if you want Marin now from West Australia, you get him from Noel Morrisby, is it Noel? And he'll post them to you anywhere in Australia, and he's posting out all the time. All fish travelling everywhere all the time now. It's become more of a normality. Within the last 5 years, I would say, the whole scene has changed in aquaculture from a theoretical to a practical system. Oysters, not a good thing to rear in ponds. There are two ways to rear oysters. You can rear oysters as spawning oysters and sell spat, which is the highest income, or you can rear oysters, which is hard work. There's a marvellous publication came out of New England. It's called "So You Think Oysters Are Going to Feed the World?" And it's a marvellous thing. And it was written by a guy who really put his heart into rearing oysters in New England. And he shows clearly that a few acres of oysters do feed the world. Very few acres of oysters will feed the world. The production is something off the wall in terms of total protein per unit areas. Nothing comes close to it. Nothing in the world comes close to it.
Mussels
probably just as good. Then he points out that you're not going to feed the world, because to feed the world you need a land infrastructure. You need places to keep your oysters, transport them and so on. And it doesn't exist when you start to grow oysters. Therefore, oysters don't feed the world because only a few places in the world have set up the marketing infrastructure for you to get rid of your oysters. And that may be true about a lot of what you do. You could feed the world providing you can post out. You can feed the world providing you've got the shore facilities, the freezers and tanks to hold your stock and send them on to market. You can feed the world providing your market is ready to take your stuff. But for a lot of aquaculture that's setting up, there's no one around them at all. Therefore, they got all the yabbies and the oysters, but after you've fed the local pub, where do you go from there? It's a really good paper. It's very detailed and full of humour.
You can get oysters all right. You get hold of oysters, you can flog them. There's no problem there. The problem is
well, you can flog oysters, providing you have someone to package them and send them off, and you've got someone waiting for them. And it's not that easy unless you've got an infrastructure. You can flog them from Tasmania because we have an oyster sale infrastructure.
Oh, but there is a well-established one.
Oh, yes. In New South Wales and Tasmania, there is. Mm. But if you become West Australia's first oyster grower, your problem really is a marketing problem. And it looks as though aquatic systems are really the future production systems. You can raise anacondas. Anacondas have about a much better conversion rate than nearly any other aquatic animal. Get a 40-pound anaconda in about 12 months. You can't get anything else like that. And I've started to raise them now. It's a water snake. You can raise turtles and you can raise crocodiles.
Actually, Bill, reptiles in general have an incredible thing.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they're very good conversion rates. Anacondas look like a forthcoming, very good aquatic project, but it's a tropical project. And of course, once again, you've got to be careful when you're feeding them.
Is anybody...
I mean, anything that can swallow a steer doesn't think much of swallowing. You've seen these guys feeding crocodiles, haven't you? Yeah, they're about the wariest guys in the world, those fellas.
Yeah.
Crocodiles don't have a bad conversion rate. Yeah, they're fast. And they... yeah, especially across a sloppy mud flat, they can hit a fair rate while you're still struggling. It's real, real dream material. Watching a 15-footer speed past you across the bloody mangrove flats, Jesus.
Has anybody done work on dry land reptiles?
Yeah, Aborigines have done it. We are seriously looking at shade provision in deserts because every hole in the desert has a parenti in it, you know, every rock hole, and there just aren't enough rock holes. So you get a rock hole and kill the parenti on it, there's another parenti in that rock hole in a few days' time. And it's obvious there's a large population of desert lizards that are... There's a huge surplus population dying because of the lack of holes. In the desert, our main job is to dig holes or to make little covered ways for shelter, that's all. There's a principle we didn't go into, I guess we should have. It's called a limiting factor in environments. For instance, in the tea tree swamp where we are, there isn't a nesting hole anymore. There isn't one nesting hole. Therefore, all our duck are ground breeders, and none of them by choice are ground breeders. And therefore, our job in that swamp is to create holes for things to nest. And of course, we'll be busy about that later on.
Do you mean by hole,
mean niches or holes? Niches and holes. Well, a hole is a niche. But it's typical in the desert. I haven't seen a patch of shade, permanent shade in the desert that isn't breeding something, and they are very rare and far between. They're either breeding wild dogs or parentis or something, and you can determine how many of those. The other thing that's a determinant of animals in the desert is small water holes. I mean small, like 100-gallon water holes. And you can make those underground with ramps to them. And suddenly your quail populations come up by the billions. So the desert is probably an example of a natural invariant ecology that is self-simplified to the point where it's right below its capacity to carry life. Seed resources are enormous. The animals to eat the seed depend on water.
The lizards, are they herbivorous lizards?
Yes, herbivorous lizards.
Vegan, yeah. For weather areas?
Yes, there's molluscivorous livers.
I mean, if you were
lizards, there's seed-eating, there's fruit-eating lizards.
A biological possibility, without attempting to be humorous, is it a biological possibility?
I'm not humorous.
Is it a biological possibility that you could advise a sheep farmer on his 5,000 acres to have a finer fence and to run 60,000 million lizards?
Well, I would advise a sheep farmer to run Old Admiral tortoises because they graze exactly like sheep. Conversion ratio is much higher. We get a 40-pound tortoise in 15 months. They don't run very fast and you can use them to jack your car up. They create a marvellous lawns. They don't beat and blar, they don't scour. You can't shear them, that's another huge advantage. You don't have any shearer strikes. A friend of mine has started to buy in Old Aberon tortoises and is rearing a fair flock of them, and the conversion rate looks much better than most animals. The other very good thing in the tropics is the land crabs. There are two of those you can grow. They're easily contained and they're very large crabs and they're vegetarian, mainly detritus feeders. They combine ideally with coconuts because the main problem of the coconut is the rhinoceros beetle that breeds in the mulch, and the main food of this crab is the larvae of the rhinoceros beetle.